This is a download from the BBC. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
There's a rose garden in my hometown of Aberdeen. It sits in a public park. It's quite a peaceful place. And in the centre of this garden, there's a block of pink granite. And on top of that, there are three figures, one facing east, one facing west, and one in the middle facing north.
The central figure, the main figure that meets you as you walk into the garden at Hazelhead, is the more mature figure who's perhaps contemplating of the price of it all. In his left hand, he's pointing down to the ground, the source of the oil, and on his right hand is a spiral, a pool of oil turning into gold. It's gold leaf, and it shows the sort of price that oil has paid for these men's lives.
Reports are coming in of an explosion on board an oil rig platform in the North Sea.
The explosion happened earlier this evening aboard the Piper Alpha oil platform about 120 miles northeast of Aberdeen. A spokesman for the RAF Rescue Centre at Petrevian Fife has described Piper Alpha as a raging inferno from sea level to the top of the platform.
In what may prove to be the worst disaster in the North Sea oil industry, 192 men are missing after a fire which swept...
On the night of July the 6th, 1988, the Piper Alpha oil platform in the North Sea was almost completely destroyed by a series of huge explosions. 167 men died. The television footage of what was left of the platform, the stumps of the legs, the twisted metal, that huge fireball, is one of those iconic images that nobody really forgets, especially not those who were directly involved. 20 years on from that night, meeting offshore workers, going through old interviews and listening to oral history recordings, you can still feel the emotion, still sense the impact. The shock of realisation that such a disaster was even possible transformed the oil industry and had an enormous impact on those who worked offshore at the time. People like Ian Sokrovsky.
He couldn't comprehend what had happened. I mean, it was just beyond comprehension that something that big could disappear in a very short period of time. Nobody could possibly understand what had happened. It was just numbing.
It was absolutely terrifying. Here was this, what you believed was a solid structure that was, that you were safe here. It was safe for the elements. It was able to stand a 100-foot wave. It had been designed to last 30, 40 years. And the thing was disintegrating in front of you. It was just cracking up. There was pipes getting thrown about the deck. There was fireballs. Possibly the best description is, it was hell. Anybody who survived the Piper Alpha has been to hell.
I was trying to create all different emotions and types of men.
Sue Jane Taylor is the artist who created the Piper Alpha Memorial.
So there's the young survival suit figure, because many young men were killed in the disaster. There's a more positive figure walking out into the distance. The third figure is the roustabout figure. He's portrays this physical nature of the offshore worker. So he's sort of gallus and happy-go-lucky in a way. They're 1.5 times larger than life-size, and cast in bronze. And below on the plinth are all the names of the men who were killed.
Fewer than 70 of the 229 people on board the Piper Alpha oil platform last night are known to have survived the explosions and disastrous fire 120 miles out into the North Sea. Two of the rescuers died when their boat caught alight. More than 20 people are in hospital in Aberdeen. Some are very seriously burned. Many were injured when they jumped or were blown from the platform into the water. One said it was one explosion after the other. For some, it took an hour of struggling to get away from the burning platform. Dozens of aircraft and ships are taking part in the search for any possible survivors from the 150 still missing. Fewer than 20 bodies have been recovered so far.
The Piper Alpha disaster began to unfold sometime before 10 o'clock on a beautifully calm summer's evening. The late Bob Ballantyne, who in the years to follow was to become something of an unofficial spokesman for the Piper Alpha survivors, had been working on the platform for over a year. That night he was off duty, sitting reading in the living accommodation when the first explosion happened.
Being an electrician at the time, I thought it was an electrical explosion. So I went down to what's the recreation room. The lads were just sitting there dazed. Material had fallen off the walls. The place very, very quickly turned to smoke. Even then, we didn't realise the enormity of it because we went back to the cabin, then went up to the canteen area, and there was people up there. Once we looked out the window, we could see the flames were actually starting to engulf the accommodation. We could see them coming up by the accommodation, which was maybe about 100 feet from sea level. I think once you've seen that, you realise the enormity of it.
Back on land, Aberdeen-based BBC radio reporter Eric Crockett was at home. There had already been two small incidents reported offshore that week, so he was unsure of what to expect when he heard that something had gone wrong in the Occidental Petroleum Company's Piper oil field.
I got a call about 10:30 on the night of July the 6th from one of my colleagues in the Radio Scotland newsroom in Edinburgh. I got into the BBC in Aberdeen shortly afterwards, and I spoke to Occidental's then PR in Aberdeen, and she told me that there had been an incident on the Claymore North Water template, I think was what she described it as. So I then put the phone down and I looked at my colleague Jane Frankie, who was the television reporter, and I said to her, Occidental say it's just an incident involving some other installation as part of the Piper complex. And she looked at me and she said, well, I've just come off the phone to the RAF Rescue Centre at Petrievi in Fife. One of their helicopter pilots says that Piper Alpha is ablaze from sea level to the top of the platform.
The person Eric called at Occidental was Kate Graham. Her recollections of the night are slightly different, hardly surprising given the confusion of what followed. She was interviewed by curator Hugo Manson for an oral history project called Lives in the Oil Industry, a joint venture between Aberdeen University and the British Library Sound Archive. As Kate Graham recalls here, she was first alerted to the incident by a phone call from a local journalist asking her about the reports of an explosion offshore.
I phoned the office and I remember exactly what I said because I didn't say, has something happened? I said, nothing's happened offshore tonight, has it? To which the first chap had said, well, I haven't heard. And he turned to his colleague and I heard, down the line, I'm instigating call out. And I said, what's happened? And he said, as word of an explosion in Piper. I said, I'll be right there. So I then phoned the journalist back very quickly and I said, something has happened, I know nothing, I'm leaving right now. And I remember driving along saying, oh, don't let it be bad, don't let it be bad. And it was terrible. It was awful.
By this time, we'd gathered about 24 people with us, and we went out what is called the pipe deck, and it was only then we could see actually what was happening, that we could see 36-inch pipes, 24-inch pipes getting hurled across the platform, you know, as you would flick a match.
From explosions?
From explosions, uh-huh. And the smoke, the place was on fire, there was oil slicks around the platform, so much so that maybe half of them went inside, went back into the accommodation again because they believed they would still get lifted by helicopter.
I got there and I went to my file and I got my emergency file. And of course there was utter disbelief, nobody knew anything, and as I ran down the corridor I said to a chap, what is it? And he said, it's a rig. And I felt rather guilty because my first thought, well, is it's a rig, good, because it won't be as many men as a platform. Because we know the difference, you know how everybody calls them rigs. But then somebody said something's happened in Piper, and I've got my boss and he says there's an explosion and fire. And of course we'd no idea how severe it was at that time.
A key reason for the confusion both on land and offshore was that the very first explosion had destroyed Piper Alpha's control and radio rooms. Tragically, this also knocked out many of the platform's safety and firefighting systems, so the men in Piper Alpha had no real means of helping themselves and no one could communicate directly with them. Instead, the crew of the nearby support vessel, the Tharos, were relaying the scene as it unfolded.
We only had, I think, two lines, or one line to the Tharos, and I could hardly expect one of those to be devoted to press matters. So that's all the chaps had because the equipment had been knocked out. So we were relying on that. And of course, given that everybody was devoting their efforts to the rescue, it meant that we were getting virtually nothing.
Somewhere which did receive calls about the platform was the RAF's Lossiemouth search and rescue team. With them was filmmaker Paul Beriff, who was making a documentary about the team's work.
We got a phone call from the rescue headquarters at Petrievi. They just said the reports were quite sketchy at the time and that the rig may have been evacuated, which means that in search and rescue jargon that the rig had been evacuated in probably an orderly manner. A few minutes later, another Mayday message came on saying that the rig had been abandoned, and that's a different situation altogether. It means that people had to sort of get off quite quickly. A few minutes later, a Nimrod aircraft took off from Kinloss. The Nimrod was flying out just above us, and he came back with a message to say that he could see the fire from his position, and he was about 100 miles away at the time, so we knew then that something serious was happening out there.
The scale of this tragedy is partly down to the fact that Piper Alpha sat at the centre of an offshore network. It acted as a gathering point for oil and gas from nearby installations before the hydrocarbons were piped onshore. In spite of the emergency alert, two neighbouring platforms, Tartan and Claymore, continued to pump oil and gas to the crippled rig, so feeding the fires. When the gas lines from these platforms inevitably burst, Piper Alpha became a fireball.
When we got there, the whole of the platform was ablaze from end to end, and the sea underneath it was also on fire. We were trying to ascertain if people were still in the water around it, and no one could give a straight answer at that point, so we decided to have a quick look round. But because of the tremendous heat, the pilot couldn't go within a mile of it. The side of the helicopter was actually starting to burn.
Everybody on that platform believed, from their safety training, that they would be airlifted to safety by helicopters. It was those people who basically said, I don't think this is going to work, and basically disobeyed their safety training and found ways out of the accommodation modules through the smoke and the fire and made their way down by one means or another to the sea. Some of them jumped into the sea, some of them were able to walk down walkways into the sea, but they got into the sea and got away. Those were the guys who actually survived.
Bob Ballantyne was one of those who made it down to sea level. He was right at the bottom of the platform watching Zodiac's small inflatable rescue craft pick up survivors. He found himself clinging to the platform, unable to make the decision between the burning Piper Alpha or the oil-covered North Sea.
I don't know what was the best thing to do, stay on the platform or go on the sea. At that particular point, I seen some of my mates and the opposite corner of one was, and I thought, right, I'll just climb up again and I'll get them. At that particular moment, there was a further explosion in the platform and they were engulfed by flames. So I stayed where I was. Not long after that, there was a Zodiac had actually come right into the platform and it was picking up a survivor who was in the middle of it. Again, I was caught up in one of these fireballs and explosions, and I think there was six would-be survivors and three crew members, and the lad they were picking up, there was only one survivor, and that boat was destroyed as well.
I knew there was a big problem because I lived across from the helicopter pad.
At around 3 a.m. in the morning, Alan Swinton was woken by the sound of rotor blades. Helicopters were bringing survivors to Aberdeen Royal Infirmary, where Alan was employed as the hospital chaplain. The hospital had an emergency response plan and Alan had a key role within it. The chapel was where relatives were to be looked after. His memories were recorded in 2003, a few months before he died, for the Lives in the Oil Industry Oral History Project.
I didn't have the television on. The television on Grampian was on all night. But the helicopter came in and then another one came in and then another one came in. And I said to my wife, I'll be needed, I'll get up and get dressed. I got up and got dressed, and interestingly, which was a bit unusual, I put on my clerical collar, which identified me as the chaplain. The telephone rang, Mr. Swinton, there's a major civil accident, could you come across? I said, I'm on my way.
I was afraid,
I was terrified, and I thought this was a bad dream, this was a nightmare, that somehow someone was going to turn this off and I was going to wake up. It never happened. And also, I'd never been in the North Sea, so far away from land, and I looked up at the size of this platform, and it was absolutely huge. It was the biggest structure I'd ever seen in my life for that angle, and the noise was terrible.
Two relatives became four, became six, became 10, became 20, and suddenly the place was well filled with people. The reason why that happened was that it had been announced on television and on the radio that all casualties were being taken to Aberdeen Royal Infirmary. So Aberdeen suddenly became a focus of people coming from all over the place. And the numbers who were under the so-called care of the chaplain were now at 40. 50, 60.
I remember sitting at my desk in the press room and somebody walked in, I don't remember who, and wrote 190 missing in a Sasco board, and the room went quiet and all my people turned and looked at me and I could feel tears coming, and I thought, I can't, because if I disintegrate, so will they. So I looked and I said, oh, there are bound to be some boats around with the men on board. It won't be as many as that. And then we started thinking in terms of, what if 20 men have lost their lives? We still weren't anywhere near it. And it took several hours until we realised that the platform was gone and that dozens and dozens of men. But you still hoped they were in the water and would be picked up. That went on. It went on past the point when we knew that wasn't the case. And that was wishful thinking. It was a dreadful night.
So now we were getting to a stage where we were being flooded with more and more relatives. And then word came, no more helicopters. And I said, is somebody coming up to tell that? I said, I've got about 100, 150 relatives here. No, you just tell them. So I called everybody into the chapel and I said, ladies and gentlemen, I have to say to you, there are no more helicopters. There was a kind of stunned silence. And then groups started forming, crying, numb. What do we do now? Many of the relatives felt, I've nowhere else to go. And some of them developed a kind of bond with some of the other relatives, which was understandable. And it was good that they were together. Gradually, folk just drifted away. And by maybe 5 o'clock, 5:30, all was quiet.
A tragedy like the Piper Alpha disaster had a huge impact on the oil industry. But prior to the accident, the industry was seen as exciting and brash. It wasn't easy money, but there was a lot of money. For artist Sue Jane Taylor, the impact of oil on the Northeast was visible everywhere.
Well, I was born and brought up on the Black Isle, and in the 70s I actually witnessed the oil boom coming to the north, Nigg, Ardersier, Kishorn being built, and the sort of radical change to the whole area, economic and social. Also, you know, I was an art student in Aberdeen, so it was still sort of boom time there in a way, in Aberdeen. It's, you know, seeing the guys in their leather jackets, aftershave, almost knocking you down. So that, again, it was all around me, but it was detached. You are, because the oil industry's out there. It's away from the onshore world, the beach, as they call it.
Sue's connection to the oil industry was to become much, much closer. Soon after graduating, she'd been commissioned to paint life on a cargo vessel. one of the boats which supports oil rigs and platforms. From that point on, she'd been building a career portraying the industry, visiting construction yards and oil terminals. In 1987, she was offered the unique opportunity to see that offshore world firsthand.
I had quite a good relationship with Occidental Oil Company, and I'd visited their Flotta oil terminal previously, and they allowed me to visit Piper Alpha for a week, which was great. It was absolutely fantastic. It's like you're going into a timeless zone. You have to put on these really uncomfortable survival suits, go through all the safety procedure, and get on this helicopter, which is noisy, vibrating, and then landing on the steel, unforgiving structure way out in the North Sea.
As the oil boom of the late 70s and early 80s hit Aberdeen, another young woman was also moved by the growth of the industry. Former Occidental PR, Kate Graham.
Oh, it was exciting. I mean, the launch of Piper took 24 seconds off the barge. And it's very clever. I mean, the first time I went offshore and stood there and looked and thought, gosh, you know, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of feet down, and the oil's coming up from there. I mean, there was a well, you know, it's we weren't to know the tragedy that did occur, would occur. And, I mean, you had some wells on Piper. There was one well that produced 25,000-30,000 barrels from one well. The first Piper platform was, and always will remain, because rules would stop it happening now, the single most prolific producer in the world. It produced 343,000 barrels in August 79 from one platform.
Well, the first time I went on the Piper, and I got taken from the accommodation down to the laboratory, which was on the lower level, I thought, how am I ever going to find my way back to here again? Because it was just like a rabbit warren of stairs going over pipes, going this way, going that way, little modules. It was like some kind of giant Lego Meccano kit combined. Maybe that was part of its charm.
Ian Sikrovsky was a production chemist on Piper Alpha. That first week of July 1988, he was on the beach on his 2 weeks off. His back-to-back colleague was killed in the explosion, yet he still has fond memories of Piper Alpha.
Piper was... it was a really quite an old platform from the North Sea. And lots of things were added on. The legs and the platform had corroded badly, and they'd been filled with cement. It was not built for what it ended up doing, you know. But at the same time, working on the platform was really, really nice. It was easily the most enjoyable platform I ever worked on.
It's like a spaceship. It's a timeless, man-made structure, moving, churning. It's there for a function. And also, men are cooped up 2 weeks in this still very tight working environment, and they have to get on with each other.
How did they react to you as a woman?
I mean, this was in 87, so I was a young person in my 20s, still slightly punky at that time. An art student, so, you know, hey, what have we got here? but I felt very safe with these men, comfortable. And once they got to know me, I mean, I'm a Black Isler, and I knew some of the guys who, you know, knew other people I knew, and I knew I was serious about what I wanted to do as well, serious about portraying them, not about the technological feats which the oil companies at that time, and still do a bit, look at the oil industry. People were forgotten at that time who worked in the oil industry, and they were very proud that I was out there trying to portray it in some way.
That people had been forgotten was one of the many charges levelled at the oil industry in the days and weeks after Piper. In the immediate aftermath, Aberdeen filled with people. Industry officials, MPs, royalty. Margaret Thatcher visited briefly. The Queen spoke with survivors while the Royal Yacht Britannia was berthed in Aberdeen. Armand Hammer, Occidental's chief executive, flew in to speak publicly. The air was full of grief and recriminations and promises.
We will do our best to get to the bottom of the problem so that we can prevent accidents from this happening again.
We're looking at everything as a result of Piper. Every company is examining its own procedures, its own installations, double-checking everything to make sure that we're satisfied with what we've got in place.
No one is under an obligation to work if they consider the conditions are unsatisfactory. Everybody has the right to say, this is not safe, I will lay down my tools.
Something clearly went wrong on Piper Alpha platform, and that's what the technical investigation about, and that is what the inquiry is about. We must learn what went wrong, and we must make sure, so far as is humanly possible, that it doesn't happen again.
Conservative Secretary of State for Energy Cecil Parkinson speaking on Panorama in 1988. A public inquiry was announced to be chaired by Scottish Judge Lord Cullen. The disaster had touched everyone with a connection to the offshore industry, and the weight of expectation was enormous.
For a place like Aberdeen, which is, you know, really rooted in oil business, it really shook the whole town. The whole place, for weeks, was different. It was just completely different. Everybody you spoke to either knew somebody who knew somebody or was directly involved or had worked on it. I mean, I went back offshore a couple of weeks later, flew across the still-burning Piper. I was greeted with people who worked there who said, you know, did you know so-and-so? We used to work with them, or, you know, my uncle's cousin. It was just incredible amount of people it touched. It was just constantly in the news, and there was a real demand to know what happened, because nobody could believe something that big could disappear overnight.
The twisted wreckage that was once the Piper Alpha platform is directly below me, alongside a large floating platform with helicopters flying to and from it. From the corners of the floating platform, two huge water cannons pouring thousands of gallons of liquid every minute in cross jets onto the wrecked platform. So much so that it's obscured by a white spray. Only the outline of the metal arms of the platform are visible through it. As a helicopter banks and circles around, a plume of grey smoke can be seen rising hundreds of feet into the air, mingling with the scattered clouds just below us. As the helicopter turns again, I can see the source of the smoke, an orange ball of flame in the centre of it. Piper Alpha is still burning.
Before the investigations could get fully underway, the fires in Piper's wells had to be put out. That task fell to legendary firefighter Red Adair. Like every other aspect of the Piper Alpha disaster, the 72-year-old Texan's efforts were widely reported.
The attempt by the Texan oil firefighter Red Adair and his team to deal with the blazing Piper Alpha platform in the North Sea is proving to be one of his most difficult exploits. Paul Newman reports from Aberdeen.
Mr. Adair and his team of specialist engineers spent several hours working in highly dangerous conditions. They were forced to use ropes to clamber about the upper deck, and they worked beneath a column of spray sent from the MSV Tharros to cool down the hot metal.
See, that deck is at 45-degree angle. It's real slick, but everything is going good, and we expect the process to stay on, schedule.
As soon as the platform is safe, divers will search the seabed for remains of the accommodation module, which may contain the bodies of some of the 149 missing workers.
Raising the accommodation module and recovering the remains of the men still in it fell to the local constabulary, Grampian Police. Ian Gordon, employed at the time as Grampian's oil industry liaison officer, was the inspector in charge of the operation. As he recalls in a Lives in the Oil Industry archive interview, it wasn't an easy job.
The accommodation modules fell to the seabed, and they had to be raised. Now, we had lots of problems in raising them because they were so huge, and get special crane barges into the DB-102, which was the world's second largest crane barge, had to be deployed. And we had divers go down and go in, and they actually got one or two bodies out, but it became too dangerous for that. And they knew there were other bodies in there. So it took 3 months.
100 days after Piper Alpha was destroyed, the accommodation module was raised. The next stage was to search for the missing.
It was agreed that once we got the accommodation modules up, Occidental had a terminal at Flota in the Orkney Islands, we would load this accommodation module onto a crane barge and take it to flutter, and we would search for bodies. It involved a lot of people, because not only was it a police operation, there was health and safety executive, it was Occidental, and of course we had all the legal aspects as well. We were dealing as if this was a crime scene, and make sure that all the equipment which came out of there was taken out in a methodical way, because there would be an investigation.
We submitted all the information about Piper Alpha to the Crown Office. We did all the preparation for Lord Cullen. Our men prepared every statement. I think it was 1,500 prime statements. And of course, we had to take a lot of the bits and pieces of Piper Alpha to Peterhead as a productions in the case. We ended up with 15 volumes of report, and it was all used by Lord Cullen, and it was the only information that was used by Lord Cullen.
Alistair Lynn, former Chief Constable of Grampian Police. The public inquiry into the Piper Alpha disaster, presided over by Lord Cullen, began on the 19th of January 1989. Day after day, oil workers, families and survivors, technical experts and the media piled into the Aberdeen Exhibition and Conference Centre to hear evidence and reports. Among them was BBC reporter Eric Crockett.
It was a very harrowing at times inquiry to actually follow, because there was a great deal of technical information. Clearly, that in itself was not harrowing, but one of the things that they did, they showed the video of Piper Alpha on fire. The survivors and the relatives of some of those who were killed were at the inquiry, and we watched it in absolute silence, punctuated only by the occasional sob from the public benches, because what they're basically watching is their loved ones dying. And at the end of that video, I remember it finished and we all sat in absolute silence. Nobody said anything for at least a minute. It was almost as if, having watched the destruction of Piper Alpha all over again, everybody was reliving the full horror of what had actually happened.
It was too much for some. The realisation that North Sea oil installations, hundreds of miles from home, could be that vulnerable shook many of the men who worked in the oil industry. Ian Sikorsky.
My very first night offshore, afterwards, an alarm went, which was, it was nothing to be found, but everybody had to get up and run to the stations. I knew at that point I could not carry on doing this. I carried on for another 6 months. I said to my company, I said, I'd rather not go offshore. They sent me up to Sullivan. At the point when I was up at Sullivan, that's when all the bodies were being found in the accommodation module. That's when I started to get having some really bad nightmares and just, you know, cold sweats. It was just every day there was a name in the paper that you somebody you worked with, and I just thought I just have to get out of the oil industry. I just could not see myself living with this, and people saying to me, "Did you worked on Piper Alpha? Did you know this person? Did you know that person?" I really felt I needed to get a clean break from the oil industry.
For those who stayed, the Cullen report was a wake-up call. Nearly 2 years after the hearing began, and meticulous in its detail, Lord Cullen's report into the Piper Alpha disaster was published on the 12th of November, 1990.
Running to 500 pages, covering the heroic, the harrowing, and the highly technical evidence, which culminated in a pile of transcripts several feet high, this report into the oil industry is the most wide-ranging ever undertaken, its recommendations the most far-reaching for North Sea development and production in the future.
The first part of the inquiry had been to establish what went wrong. So much of the platform was completely destroyed that a definitive answer has never been found. Instead, all reports refer to a most likely scenario, namely that a gas condensate pump, which had been patched for repair, was wrongly started up when an alternative pump failed. The staff on shift at the time were unaware that the repairs were being carried out. Gas comes through at huge pressures, and inevitably the patch failed. The resulting gas leak ignited, which caused the first explosion and led to the first oil fires. As the emergency backup systems failed, the gas pipelines from neighbouring platforms ruptured, causing massive explosions and the fireballs, which ultimately destroyed the platform. Cullen laid much of the responsibility for the disaster at the feet of the oil company and the government.
His criticism is levelled absolutely at Occidental management, who, he said, were too easily satisfied that their permit-to-work system was being operated properly. They failed to provide proper training to make sure it did work. They adopted a superficial attitude to the assessment of the risk of a major hazard. The platform personnel and management were not prepared for a major emergency as they should have been. The safety policies may have been in place. The practice, he says, was deficient. The Department of Energy failed too, said Lord Cullen. He describes their inspections of Piper as superficial to the point of being little use. Their last inspection of Piper was less than a month before the disaster. The inspectors passed the installation.
The strength of the criticisms and anger towards Occidental was huge. Yet, as the report was published, the company's UK chairman, Gene Grogan, struggled to respond.
I do have engineers and safety personnel reviewing the reports right now. I personally haven't had a chance but to just take a cursory review of that, so I can't comment at this time one way or the other.
He says that, for example, your attitude to safety was superficial.
As I said, until, you know, I've had a chance to review the report, discuss it with my engineers and safety personnel, I really can't comment on that.
There have been some statements made with hindsight that I think have not been fair either to Oxy or to the industry. And that's a very hard thing to say when 167 men died. But when you have inquiries into such things, everything becomes black and white. And the majority, in everything we do, we operate in shades of grey. Now, that's not an excuse for slipshod safety. And it turns out, and things that none of us, you know, in the office would necessarily have been aware of, that everything was far from ideal. But I would suggest that you'd go to quite a number of other installations and things would have been the same. There, but for the grace of God, could have gone any operator in the North Sea. It was the industry that just wasn't safe enough. Overall, it wasn't safe enough.
The Cullen report was to go a long way towards making that whole offshore industry safer. The second part of the inquiry had been to determine what could be done to prevent such a large-scale disaster happening in the future. Lord Cullen made 106 recommendations aimed at improving safety in the North Sea.
His first is that all operators should be compelled to carry out a formal safety assessment to identify potential major hazards. The safety case should be updated at regular intervals and whenever there's a major change in circumstances. That platforms should all be self-sufficient in providing immediate protection for those on board. The United Kingdom offshore safety regime needs a completely new approach, he says. The current measures are, in his view, ineffective for ensuring that safety management of all operators is adequate. And most importantly of all, Lord Cullen recommends that the Health and Safety Executive should take over the policing of North Sea safety from the Department of Energy. And he demands legal protection against victimisation of safety representatives offshore.
Of all the changes, moving responsibility for safety from the Department of Energy to the Health and Safety Executive is widely cited as the most significant. It brought the offshore industry in line with similar industries onshore, and it removed what was perceived as a huge conflict of interest. That the government department responsible for the production of oil and gas should also be responsible for safety was seen as being unacceptable. Even before the Cullen report was published, the oil industry set about transforming its installations, spending money on safety and maintenance in anticipation of the report. Chris Allen, Director of Health and Safety for industry body Oil and Gas UK, reflects on the impact of Cullen's recommendations today.
If you'd asked me 2 days before Piper Alpha if a disaster on such a scale was possible, I would have said no. I was confident in the procedures and the precautions and the platform design features that were in place. It was one of those seminal moments, really. I don't think the industry today compares at all. We're in a fundamentally different place as a result.
Cullen drew out a blueprint for how the management of safety should be done in future. And over the last 10, 12 years, we've spent a lot of time and money implementing those changes. We are still not happy with all of the changes that have occurred. There's still a long way to go, but without doubt, the Cullen inquiry and the recommendations have been a major watershed, not just in the offshore oil and gas industry, but I think other high hazard industries have looked at some of the lessons that have come out of Piper Alpha.
Ronnie MacDonald, a founder of the OILC, the Offshore Industry Liaison Committee, speaking in 2002 about the impact of Cullen. The OILC is in a way another legacy of Piper Alpha, formed in the aftermath of the disaster by a handful of activist oil workers. By 1989, it was making its presence felt.
Unions representing North Sea oil workers say that 5,000 men on 35 rigs have now stopped work in a protest over pay and safety.
For the first time in 10 years, offshore workers are staging strikes and sit-ins. The action spread across the North Sea, culminating, warn the organisers, in a massive stoppage tomorrow to mark the anniversary of the Piper disaster.
And in the year which followed,
leaders of Britain's North Sea oil workers have called for an all-out strike from tomorrow morning. The action is in protest at a threat to sack more than 1,000 contract workers who've been staging sit-ins on installations.
There were some unions involved in the oil and gas sector in the 1980s, but activism was strongly discouraged by the industry. And the unions had very little real influence offshore. Current convener of the OILC, Jake Malloy.
OILC was originally set up as an unofficial body to circumvent the anti-trade union laws that were in place at the time. It was a cry for help, essentially, from a workforce that had no mechanisms, no trade union recognition mechanisms, no trade union support. The only time trade unions were tolerated was during the construction phase of oil installations. The minute oil came onto the installation, the unions were effectively dismissed.
Since the passing of the Employment Relations Act in 1999, offshore workers have had the right to be represented by a trade union. The OILC is now an official body, part of the RMT. However, membership of any union is still very low in the North Sea, less than 25% of offshore workers. Nevertheless, in terms of safety issues, the OILC has become an important presence offshore. Post-Cullen, the unions were among many voices, alongside some of the families who'd been directly touched by the Piper Alpha disaster, who campaigned for the prosecution of Occidental Petroleum. The Cullen report was placed in the hands of Scotland's then Lord Advocate, who ultimately decided that too much of the evidence was unobtainable. The men were dead. The platform's remains had been deliberately blown up. There were no criminal proceedings. Occidental left the North Sea in 1991. The Piper field and its assets have since been sold on again.
I was one of several artists approached to submit some preparatory drawings and work for the memorial. So I went through the selection and I was chosen. And therefore, you know, I started the journey really with these families because I had to work closely with them. One of the figures, the central figure, I was finding it hard to find someone because I had life models for each of the figures. And it was suggested that one of the survivors could come. So it was Bill Barron, a survivor, who actually stood for me. And it was really good for Bill as well because it was almost like a sort of positive thing that he was doing for the men who didn't get out, and for his own sake, talking about the whole disaster to me, because he was very troubled at that point as well.
I took to drinking before I finally realised there was no future in that and just stopped it. But the relationship with the wife had become very strained, and she gave up her job to look after me. No, just to keep me about the house during the day. You know. It's there with me all the time. Like, there's no way I'll forget it. Probably never forget it anyhow. But I thought modelling with it and something to do with it might just help me to come to terms with it, which I think it has done.
We're standing just beside this memorial. Do you come here regularly?
Ever since it was erected in 1991, I've come here probably about 9:45 on the 6th. I haven't missed one. I just come up here.
Just about the time it started?
Just the time the first explosion started. And just go through all the names, remember the guys I used to know. You know, you can still see them. I can still see them. I can still remember which football teams I supported. It's still alive with me, you know.
When you come here in the evenings of the 6th, are you alone?
It's for years I have been. Most of the people arrive during the day. There's usually some service during the day. Most of the families turn up during the day. Usually when I arrive, on occasions I have been the sole person here. The only thing I would say is recently I've started noticing a lot more younger people coming in, just coming down very quickly, laying a bunch of flowers and leaving. I can only surmise that these must be the children of some of the guys who are here, who just maybe want to come down, like myself, at the moment, at the time that it all kicked off.
The new owners, Talisman, agreed to sponsor my exhibition at the Aberdeen Maritime Museum, but they had an idea that to complete the story, to close the book in a way, is actually to return to the Piper Field. And when they first suggested this idea, I was taken aback. I was quite against it in a way because the emotion swelled up again. And they persuaded me, and I was really pleased they did, because it was like meeting my ghosts. Because only 600 metres from the new platform, Piper B, is the beacon where the Piper Alpha stood. And it was like saying goodbye, you know, to these men. But the OIM,
the offshore installation manager,
right, he said that he hates Julys and he never looks out at the beacon, never. And the men just try to not look out at the beacon of Piper Alpha. So there's always that history there, that tension, that they're so close to the site.
So the uncomfortable memories of Piper Alpha are still being kept alive by its only two tangible remains, the memorial and the beacon. But what of those changes in the oil industry? 20 years on, and the North Sea is, as it ever was, a hazardous environment to work in.
More than 100 men have been evacuated from a North Sea production platform after a major gas leak. Police confirmed a major incident had taken place on the Piper Bravo installation 120 miles northeast of Aberdeen.
About 8:30 this morning, our colleagues at Aberdeen Coast Guard got a call from the Thistle Alpha platform reporting a serious fire.
It is with deep regret that we are here this morning to confirm the deaths of two of our colleagues on the Brent Bravo platform.
It's now feared that 11 people were killed when a helicopter crashed in severe weather conditions in the North Sea off Shetland.
Inevitably, there are still incidents, still accidents. But are the lessons of Piper Alpha, now a part of history, still remembered? How much safer is the North Sea today? Offshore trade unionist Jake Molloy.
There's no doubt there's been improvement since Piper, on the hardware side. I personally feel that it's highly unlikely we'll ever see another Piper Alpha, certainly not in the North Sea. Albeit you can never say never, because the hardware is only as good as those that are maintaining it. And Cullen said it all those years ago, that it's important that workers feel they're able to influence safety on a day-to-day basis. If they don't, they disengage and they just go through the motions.
That a union man should talk about the importance of workforce empowerment is perhaps not surprising, but that accusation of oil workers feeling unable to raise safety fears is one that has been frequently aired over the years. This is Professor Charles Wolfson, Chair of Labour Studies at Glasgow University, speaking in 2000.
In the early 1990s, the government and the industry together launched an extensive programme of cost reduction called Cost Reduction in the New Era. And in my view, cost pressures are simply compromising safety. Where workers are under pressure, where they have to get the job done, where they are less able to question the directives of their first-line supervision, these are precisely the conditions in which accidents occur. In other words, when cost pressures increased in the industry, then the level of incidents tended to increase as pressure was put on workers to produce in order to assist the profits of the industry.
Today, the practices of some oil companies are still a concern for the regulator. Ian Hewell is current head of the Health and Safety Executives Offshore Division.
We talk to trade unions, we talk to safety representatives, and they tell us we know the companies who have safety cultures that don't lend themselves to the workforce feeling happy about speaking up. And safety culture, which is really the attitude of the companies to the whole safety business, is critical in this. And if a worker believes that that he's not going to be listened to, and if there is a risk also that in some way they may be penalised, they're simply not going to be involved. And involvement is vital because the people that know what's going wrong and what the risks are the people on the ground who are doing the job.
But Chris Allen from Oil and Gas UK, the industry organisation which represents offshore operators, believes that workforce involvement and safety is a strength of the modern oil industry.
The industry today doesn't compare at all with the industry of the 80s. I mean, the workforce is actively encouraged to be involved, to raise safety issues, and indeed we require them to raise safety issues. And certainly within the industry, we've had a number of cross-industry initiatives, perhaps the best known of which is Step Change in Safety, where the whole industry gets together under a leadership team of 30 managing directors who meet every few weeks just to talk about safety. So the whole culture has changed. Now it's very much the balance between production and safety is very much more if safety is at risk, then you don't do it.
And what are the platforms themselves? Before the Piper Alpha disaster, maintenance regimes were mixed. In the years since, the oil industry has put a lot of money into improving the fabric of their installations. However, a health and safety executive report published in November 2007 had some worrying findings. Colin McFarlane is Emeritus Professor of Subsea Engineering at the University of Strathclyde.
What they were looking at essentially was what they called asset integrity, the overall integrity of the whole system, the pressure systems, the structural systems. Not surprisingly, the structural systems were okay. And they said that the overall envelope, if you like, of containment of the high-pressure gases was reasonably well kept. But within the system, there were gross deficiencies. There were safety items of safety critical equipment that weren't maintained. There were items of safety critical equipment that weren't even there anymore. So that if an incident happened, then a small incident can very rapidly become a very big one.
There were certainly situations where immediate action was necessary on behalf of the company to put right issues that we found, or we took enforcement action because the extent of the situation was so serious that we felt that we needed to formally enforce.
But Chris Allen insists that the industry is responding to the HSE's findings.
The underlying fact is that the industry, because of the high oil price and the longevity of the fields offshore, now faces a longer future than any of us foresaw, say, 20 years ago. So that means that the installations may have to be there for another 25 or 30 years. I think it is true to say that because we didn't see this extended future coming, perhaps in the 1990s, insufficient attention was paid to some of the fabric maintenance and the issues of integrity. But the industry had already picked up on this prior to the HSE's report. And we are now spending probably close to a third of all the expenditure on operating costs on maintaining the integrity of our installations.
Piper Alpha remains the world's worst offshore accident. The tragic loss of 167 men, fathers, sons, husbands and brothers, means that even after 20 years, the memory of it is still fresh and still relevant. What is their legacy? Is working offshore safer nowadays? Well, the answer has to be yes. Will it ever be 100% safe? Probably not. And that's why the events of July the 6th, 1988 are still talked about, still held up as a warning, and why so many people are determined that Piper Alpha should always be remembered.
You cannot ever stop striving for improvement. You must continue. That's what this industry is built on, continuous improvement. You can't relax. You've got to be vigilant all of the time. Take your eye off the ball 1 second and you could be killing hundreds, literally hundreds of people and ruining thousands of lives.
There's got to be hope for the future for lads who work in the North Sea. It's got to be made a safer environment for them as well.
There are still times when I can't believe Piper has happened. It's still unreal at times. It wasn't a list of names that we got in. It was a name that you immediately saw the face. And with the platform disintegrating, it was just so unreal, so unreal.
Just a ridiculous loss of life, really, you know. And I can still see these people, you know. It just doesn't... I don't want to forget it, because it's had such an effect on my life. I just know the events of that night changed my life. I just don't want to forget it.
If you've enjoyed this programme, you might like to try other Radio 4 podcasts, including Start the Week, lively discussions chaired by Andrew Marr, and a weekly highlight from Radio 4's evening arts programme, Front Row. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/Radio 4.